Go over there directly. Go ahead.
This is a question for George.
Please stand up, guys, so that we can see you.
Where are you? Your eyes back there. I see you.
This is Diana Albers from The Times. This is a question for George. You're recognised for your work as a writer as well as an actor and director. If you can generalise, what would you say about the quality of script writing today and how it compares with film, the classics of cinema's golden age? And would you say there's been a decline in standards? And what was it about this film that really...
Well, I'm glad you asked me that question on this film. Because it seems appropriate. This script, for instance, I think may go down in the history books as one of the great screenplays of all time. And so I think we've raised the bar back to the golden age of film. This film was basically a cry for peace. You know, there are an awful lot of good scripts out there right now. There were a tremendous amount in the golden age, too. I don't know, it's I think you always get lucky with a good script. There's not a whole lot of Paddy Chayefsky's out there anymore.
Question here and question there.
Yes, Bruce Kirkland from Toronto Sun Media. Also a question for George Clooney, right here. Or anyone else who wants to answer it. This film is being, you know, obviously it's an entertaining romp. It's being presented at Cannes out of competition. At the same time, here you are doing a lot of serious work in terms of fundraising, using Cannes as a platform to attract the rich and famous and make sure they're a little less rich and the money goes to other causes. Could you talk about balancing, again, the entertainment romp of presenting this film and also doing the serious fundraising work?
Well, we did the film, and it is an entertainment romp. I always like that word.
Romp.
Romp, right through it, actually. But, you know, the truth is we knew we were coming here. We knew that this is a great international platform. We were going to come here to promote the film, and we thought, well, if we're going to be here, there's going to be a lot of international cameras and a chance to raise some money and help some people immediately and raise awareness about something that is individually important to all of us and is something that we've worked on. We thought that there was a great opportunity to try to do both, and that's what we're basically trying to do with that.
And can you be specific, perhaps, about fundraising for Dark Four?
Well, specifically about Dark Four, Don, Brad, Matt, and I have all in the last year been in that region and around there. It's something that has been an important part of a lot of us on this panel's lives for the last few years. And we thought it was time to get up and try to, you know, we find that there's a lot more attention in the United States than there is internationally at times about this issue, and we thought it was important to be talking about it. It's not going to go away until the rest of the world is outraged enough to put a stop to it. So that was our job. Anybody else want to take that?
Yeah, it just felt like we'd be remiss. There were so many resources being brought to bear to get this film open that, given our individual interest in what was going on there, it seemed like we'd be remiss if we didn't try to redirect some of those resources towards something that is a life and death struggle happening right now as we sit here.
Ma'am?
Ann Thompson of Variety. I love the Oprah joke, and I'd like to know how it came to be in the movie. And are you all going to do the Oprah show together?
I have to sleep with Oprah in order to get on the show.
Dinner theater near you.
Steven's got to give you the answer to the Oprah story.
It was in the script.
You got it?
There was no
she was great, though. She was, I have to say, watching her, I don't know what the word for it is, empire, the way it functions, the people she has working for her, it was really impressive, I have to say. We went and watched, we brought Andy there, we watched her tape a show, and then she did our segment between that show and another show. I was really, really impressed by her and everyone around her, I have to say. It was a really fascinating afternoon.
Yeah. It was like fluorescent. Stephen directed it. It just looked like that.
Great. Impressive.
Great.
And he didn't really sleep.
And she thinks his name's Terry Benedict.
Christian, there, then the lady here.
Mr. Clooney, Marko Njegić from Croatia, Slovana Dalmatia. First of all, Ocean's 13 is far better than 12. Congratulations. is there going to be an Ocean's 14? What do you think of Croatian actor Goran Višnjić, who came on board when you quit the show? And are you ever going to get married? Not with Mr. Višnjić, of course.
All in those orders? I think I'll let Jerry take those questions. Goran, I know very well. I like him very much. He's a terrific actor and a nice man. Marriage, let's see, in order of questions, yes, no, and no. Ocean's 14, talk to Jerry. We think we sort of sapped that tree, but Jerry may be doing it with children in the next one.
We don't know what's going to happen yet. Look, let's get this one out there. Then we'll talk about the other one.
Maybe here, the gentleman there.
Hi, I'm Anjali from India. I'm a writer-director, writing specially for DNA on cinema. I have a question for Mr. George Clooney. One sees you as a promoter of serious, intelligent cinema. As a director, one is really fond of your work. And then comes the Ocean series, which is interesting. It's entertainment, of course. Where does your heart lie?
Well, I want to do musicals most, actually. That's what I want to do more than anything. You know, my heart lies in cinema. I like doing films. I think all of us up here are fans of films. All of us up here work on different kinds of films all the time. And so, you know, I think there's a great place for big entertainments. And I think there's a great place for smaller films that get things up. Every one of these actors up here works on small, passionate films of theirs that they want to get in. So I think everybody has that same sort of sense here. All of them. Except for Matt. He doesn't care.
Question, who has the mic here? Go ahead, go ahead.
Hi, Sam Cleveland for Steve Sober. Ocean 12 is smoking hot. Sorry. 12 is smoking hot, by the way.
Okay, well, you guys can get into it.
What did you say? It's your what?
12 is smoking hot.
He's Ocean's the one who liked it.
He's the one.
They're very smart. You know, Croatia has a problem. I think. Very clear.
You're welcome to join us on the next tour.
That's right.
That's how
travel
I
with us.
Travel.
Oh wait, that's Stephen's brother.
I know you.
I'm having a hard time putting a finger on what you're doing photographically with these three. The camera work. the camera work is a bit new wave, and the lighting scheme, I would call it jazzy. It's an unusual way to shoot a studio feature. Can you enunciate what you're doing? Like, if you had a cinematographer, what would your conversation with him be? If that's the way to make sense.
Question.
Oh God!
What are you smoking?
Come on, yes.
One of the pleasures of making a movie like Oceans, or making movies like Oceans, maybe the only pleasure, is I get the opportunity visually to play in a way that's not really appropriate for another kind of film. And I can push things both in terms of movement and editing, and in this case, color, in a way that if you're making a serious movie, it would just take people right out of the film. So there's an assumption. It comes from that side of the room, not this side of the room, that if you're making an entertaining film, that you're not as engaged, that you're not as into it, that you're not as passionate about it. I don't work that way. I don't think any of the people here work that way. You know, as George said, we just love making movies. And these are, from my standpoint, the Ocean's films are more difficult for me than some of the serious films that I've made, that I've gotten much more attention for. They're tricky. They're really tricky. But for me, it's a side of my interest and my personality that I really like to explore occasionally. I think to make all If I made every film like Oceans or I made every film like Traffic, that would be a trap. That wouldn't be interesting to me. So.
No, definitely.
Yeah, we want to be in competition. We don't
know
where
we're not in competition.
Hey, you guys keep saying that.
We thought we were going to win.
I don't understand. There's got to be a category we can win.
There's like a Cyrano category for you, Matt, that you could win.
Well, I got it.
Oh, yeah. Shabo, you didn't say a word yet.
Shabo, tell him something,
Shabo.
What's that sort of
Oh, yeah. You always say that.
You always say that.
Come on, tell him something real, Shabo.
How's your boy?
I don't know a little bit about Al Pacino, tell
him. Al Pacino, where are you? I don't know where he's at.
What do you say, Steve?
Al Pacino, I don't know where he's at. Where is he?
He doesn't know where he's at.
Okay, now that's Al and Oprah are dead.
Okay, thanks. Sir, that was going to be my question, Stephen Schaefer, Boston Herald, hello everybody. But I was going to ask George, Matt, and Brad, what was it like for this third time, which it looks like really it will be the last time unless we're going to get to Oceans 58 or 69. And for Brad, Angelina was saying what a good producer you were working on A Mighty Heart. I wondered how your fight with Warner Brothers was going over Jesse James over the final cut on that.
There's no fight with Warner Brothers. They've been really supportive and great with us. And when we missed
the departed too.
Thank you. And we when we missed last fall's window editing wise, it's a fall movie and it works. We're really proud. As far as Mr. Pacino, naturally he was nervous at first, but he seemed to take notes well from each of us, and
he had a bright future.
Yeah, he settled in after a few weeks.
Do you think?
Yeah, I was surprised he was so receptive to the notes.
Just make a statement about Pacino. He can't be here because he's doing an AFI tribute. They're doing an AFI tribute, so we wanted to be here. But that aside, when he came to work the first day, he said to me, "What do these guys think of me? After all, you know, they've been together for a couple of movies now, and they know each other, and they're friends, and they work together all the time. What do they think of me?" You know, I said, "Very easy question to answer." And he said, "What's the answer?" I said, "What did you think of Brando when you did Godfather? That's what they think of you." And that's exactly what they thought.
It's true. He definitely raised our respectability a little bit. He certainly brought his down.
we try to bring the classy guys down.
But on the other hand, Ellen Barkin brought the whole thing up.
Easy.
Wow. Jerry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi. My name is Janice. I'm from Hong Kong Cable Television. This question is for Mr. Steven Soderbergh. Being a Pongo director and bringing Ocean 13 to Cannes, how would you respond to the comments about Cannes being more and more commercialized, and also about your stereotype of Chinese in your movie? We might not have enjoyed it as much as the rest of the world. Can you tell us why you choose to portray Chinese that way? Can you tell us about that?
In what way were you offended if that is the word?
Well, about Chinese not being able to speak English as fluently, and also the character of Xiao Bao being like a clown, more of like a clown, I would say that Hong Kong
more than me wearing a
more than my giant nose that I'm wearing.
Lucky. This is Barton. Your mic is not on.
I'm really sorry that was your response. As they all said, I think the movie is an equal opportunity offender. I don't think anybody in the film is left out of being ridiculed. In the first film, the setup was they needed an acrobat to perform a certain duty in the film. The running joke that everybody understands what Chabot is saying, I think, is one of my favorite things in the three films. It could have been somebody from any culture that had that joke. It's sort of like Chewbacca in Star Wars. He talks all the time, and everybody acts like they know what he's saying. That's just a joke. So whenever we're in a situation where somebody's asking to explain why something's funny, then we're dead. Like, I don't know how to explain something that's funny. I'm really sorry.
Did you refer to me ever as an older woman, by the way? Because I find that offensive.
Well, we did what we could.
Just old lady.
No, not old lady. The lady here.
Wife,
I'm sorry. Yes.
Well, maybe we should ask him that.
Yeah, ask him,
Steve. Explain to her what the question was.
Well, she can ask him in Chinese.
Yeah.
Do you speak Chinese?
Yeah.
Well, ask him in Chinese.
Mandarin or
Cantonese?
Either way.
这个问题是因为我们会中国人，我们会觉得在这部电影里面，你的那个角色有一点是，不是代表我们全中国人的那个形象，你会不会觉得你的角色有一点就是，有一点会觉得你没有代表到我们中国人的那个思想啊，那个形象有没有一点的委屈，你会觉得这样子？
Shelby, you want me to take it?
我觉得还好啦，觉得这个也是一种艺术了，也是一种表演的方式。
Is that okay?
What do you say?
Good.
This is the best entertainment.
Peter Hall from Toronto Star. I just wanted to ask, where did the joke about the Sinatra handshake come from? And how many of you gentlemen actually had the pleasure of shaking Sinatra's hand?
Jerry did.
I should have
Sinatra's daughter's hand.
I shook his hand, my friend. We worked together for many years.
I shook his hand.
Elliot shook his hand.
Elliot shook his hand.
Basically, you know, the older people.
According to the writers, that's a sort of common, urban myth, but it's a story that there's this, if you shook Sinatra's hand and you're dealing with somebody else who did, you're supposed to be a code. Is that true, really?
That's true.
It's true.
Oh, yeah.
It's definitely true.
Question over here.
Hello, Matt. Matt, Helen here. Matt. Hi, Helen from Australia. Hi. Hey. I'm just wondering, a few little questions for you. I'm just wondering if you're going to be depressed to be leaving this character and Jason Bourne behind in such quick succession, and what you've taken away from both experiences. And what is your favourite aphrodisiac?
Whoa.
Because
Matt,
those are
Matt,
all related.
Matt,
here.
Yes. You gotta do that on the set all the time. Matt. Matt, here, Matt.
That's the answer to your final question. In this movie, it's really unique because I've played him completely differently in all three films. So I think in terms of leaving it behind, it's more sad thinking that this group, you know, may not do another one. I hope we do, and we'll see. I'm leaving all my options open. The Bourne thing I'm definitely done with, though. and that's coming out in a few months, and it's terrific. But, you know, I think we've ridden that horse as far as we can. So, other than feeling a bit like a prostitute putting out two number threes in one year.
Better than three number twos.
At least you've got your aphrodisiac.
What's that?
At least you have your aphrodisiac.
Yes, I have my aphrodisiac to help numb the pain.
So that means Jason Bourne dies?
No, well, I'm not saying whether he dies or not, but...
There's no other way to end these.
I could just not do them anymore. No, I think the character, you know, the character lived on in the book, and so, you know, I'm sure somebody else wanted to come and play the part.
It's like a Bond series. Somebody else will play Bourne.
The most difficult part is just to get back to Oceans for a minute, then you come back to Cannes and promote Bourne. The fact of the matter is that Stephen didn't say this and can't say it, but this is an ensemble piece. Everybody up here, all these actors up here, work together and they give to each other. And Stephen finds a way to give them all a place in the film to have something to say, for their characters to grow. And that's the most tedious and difficult thing that he has to do on this film. It's a very, very hard thing to take care of 13 actors and 13 characters and make it all work and weave it all together. He does that. He deserves a fantastic round of applause. Sex and Life and Videotape, one thing, it's a great film. I love it. I love Traffic. I love everything he does. I think he's the greatest director working today. And I love working with him, all these actors, it is an ensemble piece, and that's why it works, and that's why it goes on, and that's why it's so good.
Madam?
Giovanni Grassi, Corriere della Sera, Italy, is a question to Soderbergh and Wayne Chow, the producer. Can you tell us something about the real Las Vegas? What is changed today with the Kerkorian Bethesda? Almost all the hotels. What is in the soul of the Americans that from all the states go Vegas for every weekend? So we are curious about your point of view on Las Vegas today.
Well,
I don't know that I'm entirely qualified to answer that. There's something compelling about that city, for sure. What's amazing to me, I'm sure to most of us, we've been there, even since we were there 5 years ago, it's changed. You keep thinking it can't get any bigger, there can't be any more hotels, you keep thinking it's gonna reach a peak, and it just keeps going. As a sort of social experiment, it's kind of fascinating. I don't know where it's gonna end. I think the one thing that'll never go away is this idea that there's some place that you can go and just cut loose and everybody feels this is the place they can go and do that. They come from all over the world. I mean, half the tourists there are coming from outside the United States. There's something very compelling about it. Jerry?
I know, because I went to Vegas the first time in 1947 when I was 9 years old, and there were three hotels there. The Sands Hotel, the El Rancho Hotel, and the Flamingo Hotel. They were all owned by different mafia people in America and from different cities. Vegas then changed. Howard Hughes came to Vegas and made Vegas into a much more of a resort area, and a lot of companies started to come in there. That went through the 50s and 60s and part of the 70s, and then big corporations started to come in and buy the hotels. They tried to make it into a family resort. That went on for about 10 years. After that, they turned around and said, well, family resorts are nice, and little trains with smoke coming out and going around hotels is very nice, but strip clubs work better. Much more money. And they had the gambling, and it became, again, it has now transformed itself into this place that, first of all, it's not a little city anymore. It was a little sleeping town. It's 2.5 to 3 million people living in that valley. There's a fantastic amount of money being gamble there every minute of every day, and the city has evolved. They have a wonderful university, they have art galleries, they have museums, they have blah, 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 but they also have this place that is, for whatever they for whatever that kind of entertainment is. It is the entertainment destination, the number one destination in the world. It's a lot bigger than Disneyland and a lot bigger than anything else. So that's where people want to go. They want to go to Vegas, as Steven said, cut loose. They feel once they hit that ground, once they hit those casinos and clubs and restaurants and they have the finest in the world there, they can just do anything they want to do and have a great time, and they do. So it's a fun place for everybody.
And the strip clubs aren't as good as Disneyland.
They're not?
See Goofy take his pants off?
Hey, that's been the transformation of Vegas over the last, since I've been to 50-some years.
Sir.
Un, deux. Oui. Madame Lucet Pompleu, c'est une question pour Monsieur Clounet et Monsieur Soderbergh. On l'a dit tout à l'heure à propos de la main de Frank Sinatra, et puis la scène où Brad Pitt et George Clooney évoquent les casinos disparus, que sont le Dunes ou le Sands. On a vraiment le sentiment qu'il y a un parfum de nostalgie qui flotte sur le film, peut-être pour l'ancien Las Vegas. Est-ce que c'est un peu l'esprit du Rat Pack qui vous réunit tous ici aujourd'hui et que vous voulez célébrer?
Could you repeat that?
No, I will. The question is, because of the way the Brad Pitt character and George Clooney character sort of go back and evoke the dunes and the sand, the old hotels from way back when, is there a kind of tinge of nostalgia? Yes, sir?
Oui, c'est ça.
Is there a kind of, plus, not to mention the Sinatra handshake, is there a kind of nostalgia on your part about that kind of long gone Vegas?
Well, I have a sense of nostalgia about eras in general. I like, you know, I like when people put on suits to go into a casino, and now it's, you know, long shorts and espadrilles. So, you know, I think it's, you know, there's things I am nostalgic about, and I think they're kind of classy and fun to do. But, you know, this film wasn't about nostalgia, really. Maybe someone else thought so, but I mean, we talk about it for a second. But not really, I don't think so.
I think it's human nature to, as I was walking in here, I realized that it was 18 years ago that we were here with Sex Lies. I think when I look back on that, I certainly feel like the festival has gotten bigger. It's got, you know, you. I think it's normal to look back and say, "Oh, it was great then. It was the first time I was here. It seemed more innocent." Of course, it probably wasn't. But that's. I think it's just part of life that you look back on a past experience and perhaps, you know, color it a little bit and make it seem better than it was. I just think that's human nature.
It was not.
What, like 18 years ago?
Yes.
It was.
Question here, then question there. Hi, over here, Brian Johnson from Appliance Magazine in Canada. A question for Mr. Soderbergh. Steve, you talked about how you try to apply your talents with equal passion for the commercial and more serious films. These two worlds have become, it seems to me, more and more two solitudes. There was a time in the 70s when they were at least momentarily one and the same thing. I guess I'm curious to hear what both Mr. Clooney and Mr. Soderbergh have to say about this. Can we, you know, hope for a time when these two different worlds of filmmaking start to find a middle ground, and how will that happen?
Well, we're only partially in control of that, in the sense that you can make a film that perhaps bridges that gap, but if it isn't well reviewed and people don't show up, then you're not going to see very many of them. So it's not as straightforward as you might think, as just making a movie that seems to be both commercial and has some substance to it. I won't bore you with a list of examples, but I'm sure I could come up with a list of 10 films that over the last 10 years I think have bridged that gap, and they haven't been commercially successful, and that's the business we're in. So. You can't always blame the filmmakers and say, why aren't you making better films? Because there are plenty of really good films. I'm sure there's some here at this festival that are never going to find an audience. And that's not, that's something we can't entirely control.
Question way over there.
Eddie Aramuni, LBCI 11. On a question for Mr. Soderbergh. Congratulations on this movie. And by the way, excellent choice for Mr. Barton in Female Legal, absolutely sexy to say the least. What was it like, you know, what was it like, you know, having to deal with over 15 big names in your movie, whereas as you know, other directors would have probably fallen apart. Thank you.
We, when we began this process with Jerry years ago,
you look, you had hair.
Yeah, I have hair a little more than I do now. We made a rule that we weren't going to bring anybody on the movie that had a reputation for being unpleasant, and we stuck to it. And so,
pretty much.
No name. And that solves everything. You know, just no jerks.
Nobody came with baggage. Everybody came with baggage.
Yeah.
Question here and then there.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Karim Kojo from the ART, the AL Radio and Television. My question is for the director, Mr. Soderberg. When you get to work with amateurs or beginners, this necessarily means that you're going to face lots of difficulties, but at the same time, does working with a bunch of celebrities, experienced actors and actresses, some of which are already Academy Award winners more than once, such as yourself, so does this necessarily mean that you did not get to face any difficulty while shooting? This is one thing. The other thing is for Brad Pitt, George Clooney, and Matt Damon. How does it really feel to be Brad Pitt, George Clooney, and Matt Damon?
This is just a unique set of people. I mean, Eddie I've known since I was 20 years old. Scott's a filmmaker in his own right. Elliot, you know, was the star of some of my favorite films of all time, seminal films for me. It's when we get everybody together, it's not a joke. They don't leave the set, and the conversation ranges all over the place. It ranges from the work we're doing to, there are a lot of bright people up here, very well read, so the conversation's always flowing and is always interesting. It is. There are occasions when it's hard to get everybody to be quiet and focused and stand in the right place.
Matt.
I don't know where I was. But, it's worth it. Matt, what is it like to be George? I'll tell you what it feels like. To be George. I think it would be tough to talk about what it feels like to be yourself, because you can't really compare it to anything else. Except for George, who goes so deep into character when he plays Danny Ocean that he can probably actually step outside himself and take an objective view.
So. I'm sorry, I'm still Danny. I can't talk. Talk about yourself.
You have nothing to say. There's no way out.
There's no way out. I'm stuck.
I don't know. What's it like to be... Hungry.
Oh, it feels great.
Good. There he goes.
Hi, Rodrigo from Globo Brasil. To Mr. Kuhn, in your work as a director, how did your experience with Soderbergh influence you? And a question to Mr. Soderbergh. The original Ocean's 11, the one with Sinatra, is this still a reference to the part 1, part 2, and part 3, or not?
I don't know.
How am I?
Well, here's the thing. Steven steals a lot of things from me.
Which
has an influence on what I do, because I'm very careful about my shots. Still steal them. Listen, Steven has influence on most filmmakers, quite honestly, and so most of the time you could call it an influence, or you could literally call it stealing, because I've called him up and said I just stole a shot from you from a film 4 years ago. And then he'll tell me where he stole that shot from. he's the kind of filmmaker, it's not just about the kind of films he makes and the style that he shoots them, but it's also the way that a set is run. He teaches, he keeps it very calm, he works efficiently, and he gets exactly what he needs, and that teaches filmmakers a lot. Most filmmakers should go and take a a class with him. Got some really nice things to say about him today.
Good. And tell me the second part of the question again about the original film.
You wrote the part two and part three. Did you still have the original one and the reference or not?
No, I mean, I think they made, they did, how many other Rat Pack films? They did Robin and the Seven Hoods. And then was that the other one?
Sergeant 3. Sergeant 3, but they did other things together.
Yeah.
It's a combination.
As you can tell, you know, the main thing we were trying to appropriate was just this sense of a group of people who were close. And everything else, we kind of started over again.
We'll take a few more questions. Sarah.
Hi, guys. This is a revenge film. And, you know, a group of lovable, rascally, crafty guys get together to take a lot of money from a big, powerful ogre-type guy. Do you think it's fair to compare this film to The Sting? And if it is fair, how would you compare the two?
Oh. Well, Sting won Best Picture.
Yeah.
We're not going there.
That's, no, I mean, we love this thing. This thing is absolutely one of the most flawlessly constructed con films any of us have ever seen. I mean, it is a masterpiece of construction. There's a reason you don't see one of those very often. They're really, really hard to do. What we liked about this idea, though, was in thinking about going back one more time, and thinking about that the most appealing thing to us about the movies is the camaraderie. This idea of something, one of the characters being wronged and the other characters having to come and defend him and make that right, we thought was a good premise for us because it played into the relationships between the characters. So it was sort of a revenge film and also kind of a, you know, we don't like mean people, so it was an opportunity to watch somebody mean, you know, get his head handed to him. So that was fun.